Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your host, Alex Linder, and everything that we do, everything that I say can be found at vnnforum.com. What we're doing today is chapter 55, B'nai B'rith Leader Discusses the Jews. This is from Henry Ford's series of articles published in 1920 and 21. They were collected in 80 chapters in a book called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem, and we have the unabridged copy of that book that we've been going through in audio. And today we're going to start with chapter 55, and that will be all of this particular recording. We try to take them two at a time if they're related, as the last few have been, but this will be a standalone. So, B'nai B'rith Leader Discusses the Jews. To the pro-Jewish spokesmen who have filled the air with cries of lies and slander, to those self-appointed guardians of American ideals who rule out with rare finality all those who would dare suggest that possibly there is a hidden side of the Jewish question, it must come as something of a jolt to be reminded that in this series there is scarcely a line that is without high Jewish authority. What that means is that Ford doesn't use Goyim to prove his points about Jews. He quotes Jews themselves. He quotes their experts. He quotes their rabbis. He quotes their leading statesmen. And he quotes their so-called religious books to prove what he's saying. So, precisely in order to avoid being called an anti-Semite, though that's a joke concept, he cites Jews themselves to prove points about Jews, so that every possible objection to what he's saying has been anticipated and overcome. And the only reason for resistance to what he's saying is dishonesty and bigotry. It's basically true. Ford continues, "The protocols themselves are written for centuries in Jewish authoritative teachings and records." So we have vindication of the protocols that we discussed in earlier chapters throughout Jewish written legal history. All the plans that have been described from time to time in these articles are written in the fundamental laws of the Jew. So again, their behavior and their beliefs reflect each other. So these horrible things they appear to believe, it's not just that they appear to believe them, they actually act on them. And all that the ancients have taught, the modern Jews have reaffirmed. A People That Shall Dwell Alone was the title of one of the books of MacDonald's trilogy. And their view is, we are separate, we are apart, we are the chosen people. Other people are as animals compared to us, and we owe them nothing. We are free to treat them and dispose of them as we like. So that's the kind of people they are. That's what they believe. That's how they behave. And wherever they have power, woe to the people under their thumb and their boot heel, because it is miserable. If you see what they do to the Palestinians, the native Palestinians. The writer of these articles has had to take constant counsel of prudence in his selection of material. For the Jews have always counted confidently on the fact that if the whole truth were told in one comprehensive utterance, no one would believe it. Think about that. They're so bad, they're so brazen and so bad, so evil, that if you told the truth about us, no one's going to believe it. Like Hillary Clinton defending her husband from being a rapist. Oh, who's going to believe those women? They're a bunch of trash. No one's going to believe what's said about the Jews. They're wonderful people. I mean, you have the wisest of white men like Joe Soberman saying that, praising Orthodox Jews for their conservatism. You have foolishness like that and crying when Irving Kristol dies. These people who afflicted him, and that's his Christianity coming out, his weakness, that he saw the truth about the Jews and he turned away because he wanted to write about Shakespeare and other things that were less interesting. He didn't care about race. He only cared about his own religious, his beautiful bride, the church, even as the Jews wrecked his life and drove him, one of the few. There are lots of intelligent conservatives. All the professional conservatives are intelligent, but few of them are genuinely brilliant. Soberman was the one who was the most brilliant. the most able to turn a phrase, the most able to come up with original, fresh associations. Out of all of them, Pat Buchanan is good, but Sobrin was on another level from the rest of them. And still, this writer is saying that Jews have always confidently counted on the fact that if the whole truth were told in one comprehensive utterance, here's the full truth about the Jews, in other words, no one would believe it. Thus, bigots and minds bursting with the discoveries they have made have never been feared by Jews. They counted on the incapacity of the non-Jews to believe or receive certain knowledge. They know that facts are not accepted on proof, but only on understanding. I'm not entirely sure what that means. Non-Jews cannot understand why human beings should lend themselves to certain courses. They are, however, beginning to understand, and the proof is therefore becoming more significant. So you have to sort of lube them up or precondition them with teaching about, look, all people, you're trained to think of all people are the same. Your religion, Christianity, encourages this belief with its universalism. And then you're encouraged to think that others are motivated the way you are. So you're encouraged in a feminine mindset to smooth over any differences you notice and not even to notice those differences in the first place. Whereas you need to reverse that in order to get them preconditioned to understand Jews by explaining, look at the differences between people. Consider they might be more important than the similarities that we all share as mammals. And once you notice these differences, maybe the other fellow of the other species isn't motivated the same way you are. Well, why don't we look at his record of behavior? I mean, any animal, if you were a scientist studying it, you say, well, how does it behave? When does it eat? Is it active at night? Is it active crepuscularly? That is, at the twilight? Is it active during the day? Is it diurnal, nocturnal, crepuscular? What does it feast on? What are its mating habits? What are its optimal conditions, you see? And if you look at mankind in this naturalistic way, then you observe they fall into different and competing species as does, every other group of animals in nature. So, it's the Christian who claims that men are somehow apart from nature and that his wonderful morality can overcome these natural differences, but there's no evidence that they can. There are yet more important revelations to be made, always following closely the best Jewish sources. And when these revelations are made, it will be impossible for the Jewish leaders to keep silent or to deny. The time is coming for American Jewry to slough off the leadership which has led it and left it in the bog. Leadership knows that. Indeed, it is amazing to discover the number of indications that the attempts made to suppress the Dearborn Independent have been made principally to prevent Jews reading it. So the Jews are out there working hard to make sure that their own people are not reading this. They don't care so much of Goyim. The leaders do not care how many non-Jews read these articles, but they do not desire their own people to read them. The Jewish leaders do not desire their people's eyes to be opened. I think he's a little off on this, but let's let him have his say. Why? Because just now, only Jews can truly know whether the statements made in these articles are true or not. Non-Jews may know here and there, as their observations may confirm the printed statements. But informed Jews really know. And this is similar to something I've said about the Holocaust, which confirms, ironically, that the Jews are, in fact, a race of liars. Now, logic and reason... God damn it. I apologize for coughing. My voice is just... I try to record stuff in the morning, and maybe I get a little older. I have to cough until I get cleared up here. Yeah, I got a good baritone going, but it just gets coated up a little bit. It's annoying. Anyway, what I've always said, okay, here's the thing. Logic, reason, and facts are actually more powerful than they seem. they seem like kind of a good way to understand things, but the truth is they're stronger than that. If they're right, they absolutely work. You can have faith in them. There's not many things in this world you can have faith in, but rationality is one of them. And if you say that this person was thrown in jail for proving the Holocaust didn't happen, well, if the Holocaust actually didn't happen, if there actually were not 6 million Jews killed, and there were no gas chambers, then there are a number of implications that flow from that. And that is that there were at the least hundreds of thousands of Jews who were in these camps, as there were many in prisoner camps all over the world, and every different country had them. Now, every single one of these Jews is aware there were no gas chambers because he didn't personally experience them or know anyone who did. So if after the war there are essentially zero Jews who are admitting that fact, then we can conclusively say that they are indeed a race of liars. And it's fair to call them a race of liars because the number of Jews who admit there weren't any gas chambers, they never saw them, they never heard of anything, they never knew anyone who was gassed to death, that everything at most is hearsay, then we have a pretty powerful statement about that race of people. So that's one thing to consider. But informed Jews really know the truth about the statements made in the Dearborn Independent series. And large numbers of masses of the Jews really know. When they see the truth in all its relationships in these articles, the hitherto, quote, led, unquote, Jew may not be so tractable, so manageable. Hence, the effort to keep the non-Jewish point of view away from him. In support of the statements that these articles have been based on Jewish authority, we quote today a series of declarations by one of the most able of the presidents of B'nai B'rith, Leo N. Levy. Mr. Levy was American-born and died in 1904. He was a lawyer of distinction and attained the presidency of the International Jewish Order, B'nai B'rith, in 1900. B'nai B'rith is the ones around the world who are carrying out the orders of the Kehillah, typically, say, in New York, and the American Jewish Committee, which have a big overlap with the Kehillah of New York. He took part in the international Leo Levy. He took part in the international politics of his people and is credited with collaborating with Secretary of State John Hay on several important matters. The utterances here quoted were made for the most made while he was president of the B'nai B'rith, but all of them were published the year after his death under B'nai B'rith auspices. There is, therefore, no question of their Jewishness. Non-Jewish defenders of the Jewish program have pretended to much indignation because of references that have been made to the Oriental character of certain Jewish manifestations. The references in these articles have been two in number, once regarding Oriental sensuality, as it has been introduced to the American stage by Jewish theatrical panderers, which you heard about in earlier chapters, the Jew take over the stage and also the Jew take over of movies. And again, in quoting Disraeli, the Jew who became Premier of Britain, to the effect that the Jews, his people, were, quote, Mosaic Arabs. But it never seemed to have occurred to Leo N. Levy to deny the Oriental character of his race. Instead, he asserted it. On page 104 of the B'nai B'rith Memorial, he excuses certain social crudities of the Jew on the ground that, quote, hailing originally from the Orient, and having been compelled for 20 centuries to live in a society of his own, he has preserved in his tastes much that is characteristically Oriental. Unquote. Again on page 116, he excused the multiplicity of religious rites as being due to the fact that the Jew, quote, drew upon his Oriental imagination for a symbolism that appealed to his ideal emotions. Unquote. On page 312, he speaks of the Jews, quote, Oriental devotion to their parents, unquote. This easy recognition of the fact is commended to those bootlicking editors who, out of the vastness of their ignorance of the Jewish question, have seen in the reference to Orientalism and, quote, insult to the Jews and an unfailing indication of anti-Semitism. The Jewish question. Ah, that is another point which pro-Jewish spokesmen hasten to deny, but they will be somewhat disturbed by the candor with which true Jewish spokesmen admit the question. In a strong passage on page 101, Mr. Levi says, quote, "If I have dwelt so long upon this subject, it is because I recognize that if the Jew has been denied so much that is rightfully his, he often claims more than it is his due." One of the claims most persistently urged is that there is no Jewish question, that a Jew is a citizen like any other citizen, and that as long as he abides by the law and does not subject himself to criminal prosecution or civil action, his doings are beyond legitimate inquiry by the public at large. Quote, "This contention on his part would certainly be well based if he claimed nothing further than the right to live in peace, but when he demands social recognition, the whole range of his conduct is a legitimate subject of inquiry against which no technical demurs can be interposed. Nor must the Jew be oversensitive about the inquiry." That's kind of similar to homosexuals following the Jewish example demand special, as Levi calls it, social recognition. When he demands social recognition, then his actions on the whole become open to inspection, and the homosexual wants that social recognition without any inspection, just as the Jew does. Special privileges, but no special spotlight. The inconsistencies and the unwisdom exhibited in the consideration of the Jewish question are not to be found altogether on the side of those who are hostile to the Jews. So he's saying Jews are at fault to some degree, which is very, very unusual admission for any Jew to make, even though, of course, the truth is the inconsistencies and unwisdom are entirely on the part of the Jews. They are completely the cause of the reaction they receive. Continuing the quote, "Since then, the refugees from Russia, Galicia, and Romania have raised the Jewish question to commanding importance. Since then, it has dawned on the world that, quote, or that italics, we are witnessing another exodus that promises soon to change the habitat of the Jews to the Western Hemisphere." So the Jews are, the weight of the Jewish community is moving from Poland, Galicia, and Russia to the United States and the West, France, England, U.S. primarily. "The Jewish question cannot be solved by tolerance," says Levy. "There are thousands of well-meaning people who take to themselves great credit for exhibiting a spirit of tolerance toward the Jews." Mr. Levy also lays down the rules for the study of the Jewish question, in quotes, and he says that if they were followed, the result, quote, "would be startling at once to the Jews and the general public." Page 93. How far present Jewish leadership has departed from that frank and broad view taken by Mr. Levy is evident everywhere. Not that Mr. Levy was a critic of his people, but he was a lawyer who was accustomed to weighing facts, and he saw facts that weighed against his people. But he was pro-Jewish even in his most severe observations. He could make an attack on the rabbis, taunting them with the saying that, quote, "many of you are rabbis for revenue only." But he could also insist on Jewish solidarity and exclusiveness. In this connection, it may be interesting to see how strongly Mr. Levy supports the contention of Jewish leaders, as outlined in the Dearborn Independent of October 9th and 16th, 1920, that the Jews are a race, and not merely a religion, a nation, and not merely a church, and that the term Jew is biological rather than theological. This is specially commended to the attention of those dim-minded shouters of religious prejudice who come into action whenever the Jewish question is mentioned. Of religious prejudice, there are many examples to give in future articles. Quote, "Certain it is that thus far the race and the religion have been so fused, as it were, that none can say just where the one begins and the other leaves off." Page 116. Attacking the contention of the liberals or reformed Jews to the effect that the Jew is the name of a member of a religious denomination and not of a member of a certain race, Mr. Levy says, quote, "nothing to my mind is more pregnant with error than this postulate of unreason." Page 185. "It is not true that the Jews are only Jews because of their religion." Page 189. The Jews are not simply an indiscriminate lot of people who hold to a common belief. Page 190. A native Eskimo, an American Indian, might conscientiously adopt every tenet of the Jewish church, might practice every form and ceremony imposed by the Jewish laws and the Jewish ritual, and as far as religion is concerned, be a Jew, but yet no one who will reflect for a moment would class them with the Jews as a people. If the truth were known, a very large percentage of so-called Christians would be found to be believers in the essentials of the Jewish religion, and yet they are not Jews. It requires not only that men should believe in Judaism, but that they should be the descendants in a direct line of that people who enjoyed a temporal government and who owned a country up to the time of the destruction of the Second Commonwealth. That great event took away from the Jews their country and their temporal government. It scattered them over the face of the earth, but it did not destroy the national and race idea, which was a part of their nature and of their religion. And this is all quotes. Who shall say then that the Jews are no longer a race? Blood is the basis and substratum of the race idea, and no people on the face of the globe can lay claim with so much right to purity of blood and unity of blood as the Jews. If I have reason to any purpose, the inquiry of rights as in the premises, or the inquiry of rights in the premises, is not to be limited to Jews as exponents of a particular creed, but to the Jews as a race. Pages 190-191. The religion alone does not constitute the people. As I have already maintained, a believer in the Jewish faith does not, by reason of that fact, become a Jew. On the other hand, however, a Jew by birth remains a Jew even though he abjures his religion. This is the view of such men as Justice Brandeis, the Jew who sits on the Supreme Court of the U.S. Justice Brandeis says, "Let us all recognize that we Jews are a distinct nationality of which every Jew, whatever his country, his station, his shade of belief, is necessarily a member." Believing all this, Mr. Levi subscribes to the Jewish law and practice of exclusiveness. Describing the state of the Jews, Mr. Levy says, page 92, "The Jews have not materially increased or diminished in numbers for 2,000 years. They have made no proselytes to their religion. They have imbibed the arts, the literature, and the civilization of successive generations, but have abstained very generally from intermixture of blood. They have infused their blood into that of other peoples, but have taken little of other peoples into their own." As to intermarriage between the Jew and non-Jew, Mr. Levy calls it miscegenation. In remote countries sparsely populated, the choice may lie between such marriages and a worse relation. Those are his words on page 249. He does not advise the worse relation, but he has said quite enough to indicate the Jewish view of the case. He continues, "It seems clear to me that Jews should avoid marriages with Gentiles and Gentiles with Jews, upon the same principle that we avoid marrying the insane, the consumptive, the scrofulitic, or the Negro." How about that? There's a wonderful quote. "It seems clear to me that Jews should avoid marriages with Gentiles and Gentiles with Jews upon the same principle that we avoid marrying the insane, the consumptive, the scrofulitic, or the Negro." How about that? This exclusiveness goes down through all human relations. The Jew has one counsel for non-Jews and another for himself in these matters. Of the non-Jew, he demands as a right what he looks down upon as shady privilege. He uses the ghetto as a club with which to bludgeon the non-Jew for his bigotry, when as a fact, he chooses the ghetto for well-defined racial reasons. And this is something I've had endless debates with these half-witted Christians who do not realize the history, that it's a Jewish propaganda claim eagerly picked up by these adultish, ununderstanding Christians, that it was the Pope and the Catholic religion that forced Jews into ghetto. That's propaganda. It was the rabbis who wanted the Jews kept in these quarters, and it was the Jews themselves who didn't want to mix. They were the ones who created the ghettos, not the Catholic Church. And that false argument, which is actually we're being persecuted, claimed by the Jews, as Ford is saying here, is commonly used by racialists who think that they're also Christians, or I should put that the reverse, Christians who are pretending to be racialists to use to defend their shady cult. So, he uses the ghetto as a club with which to bludgeon the non-Jew for his bigotry, when as a fact, he chooses the ghetto for well-defined racial reasons. He condemns the non-Jew for the exclusion of the Jew from certain sections of society, when as a Jew, his whole care is to keep himself unspotted from that very society to which he seeks entrance. The Jew insists on breaking down non-Jewish exclusiveness while keeping his own. The non-Jewish world is to be public and common. The Jewish world is to be kept sacrosanct. Read the teachings of this enlightened leader of Jewry as published by the B'nai B'rith. He favors the public school for non-Jewish children, not for Jewish children. They are to be kept separate. They are the choice stock of the earth. Because the government tenders free education, it does not follow that it must be accepted. If education be made compulsory, it does not follow that government schools must be attended. As a citizen, I favor free schools because the education they afford, imperfect as it is better than none, and society is benefited thereby. But as an individual, I prefer to pay to support free schools and send my children to more select places. He speaks of the fact that, quote, all classes of children frequent the public schools as an argument against Jewish children going there. He speaks of the fact that all classes of children frequent the public schools as an argument against the Jewish children going there. In my judgment, Jewish children should be educated in Jewish schools, page 254. Quote, not only is it a positive and direct advantage to educate our children as Jews, but it is absolutely necessary to our preservation. Experience has shown that our young people will be weaned from our people if allowed indiscriminately to associate with Gentiles. Discussing the possibility of Jews losing their crudeness, Mr. Levy asks, how shall we best accomplish that end? Then he quotes the frequent answer, since the exemplars of gentility most abound among the Gentiles, we should associate with them as much as possible in order to wear away our own rudeness. Unquote. He meets this suggestion this way. Quote, if gentlemen were willing to meet all Jews on a parity because they are Jews, we should doubtless derive much benefit from such association. But while it is true that no gentleman refuses association with another because that other is a Jew, he will not, as a rule, associate with the Jew unless he be a gentleman. And we are as far from all being gentlemen as we are far from being all gentlemen. We cannot reasonably expect to be admitted as a class into good society. So, better keep by ourselves, concludes Mr. Levy. So you can see back then there was not, even though the U.S. was famous for being democratic and egalitarian, there were still very strong social class distinctions made between gentlemen and, you know, uncrude, ruffian, feral types. And these Eastern Jews in particular were seen as extremely coarse, pushy. But they didn't really care. As long as they got the money, they knew that eventually they would come into their own socially. But they were also not above demanding that the Ivy Leagues let them in great numbers, and the country clubs let them in. And eventually they took over all the institutions that had originally kept them out. If you want to see a funny representation of this, would be the movie Caddyshack, made back in 1980, where you have, you know, the very pushy, aggressive Jew developer. I mean, he's played as like a Polish name, but he's basically a Eastern European Jew who's super pushy, pushing his way into Bushwood, which is Ted Knight and the old WASP elite, who is portrayed as extremely corrupt. They always portray old WASP as fuddy-duddies and morally hypocritical and corrupt, whereas the Jew is freewheeling, fun kind of guy that all the white ethnics and just anyone normal inherently gravitate toward against the old pseudo-respectable WASP elite, you see. So Jews definitely push these memes in their movies inevitably, and we know that the bad guys are almost always shown to have blonde hair. Very unusual to have any movie with where the hero has blonde hair. Now, That is, Mr. Levy admits, the willingness of society to meet Jews on equal terms, as with all others, but not on unequal terms. And this being so, Mr. Levy holds that they had better meet as little as possible. They had better keep apart. In the formative years, certainly, Jewish young people should be kept rigidly apart from non-Jews, the exclusiveness of which the Jews complain is their own. The ghetto is not a corner into which the non-Jews have herded the Semites. The ghetto is a spot carved out of the community and consecrated to the chosen people, and is therefore the best section of the city in Jewish eyes, the rest being the Christian quarter, the area of the heathen. Mr. Levy himself admits on page 220 that there is no prejudice against the Jew in this country. So again, this is a wonderful, let me repeat this, because this is a key argument that people defending the Christian church make, is that the church kept the Jews in the ghetto, and this is specifically refuted here by Henry Ford, using the words of the president of the B'nai B'rith. The ghetto is not a corner into which non-Jews have herded the Semites. The ghetto is a spot carved out of the community and consecrated to the chosen people, and is therefore the best section of the city in Jewish eyes, the rest being, quote, the Christian quarter, unquote, the area of the heathen. Mr. Levy himself admits on page 220 that there is no prejudice against the Jew in this country. Certain wild-eyed objectors to the series studies on the Jewish question have made the assertion that the Dearborn Independent has declared cowardice to be a Jewish trait. That the statement is false as regards this paper does not change the fact that the subject has been generally discussed in and out of army circles. If it ever becomes necessary to discuss it in these studies, the facts will be set forth as far as they are obtainable. But the point just now is that Mr. Levy has had somewhat to say which may repay reading. Quote, physical courage has always been an incident, not an element, of Jewish character. It has no independent existence in their makeup, and always depended on something else. With some exceptions, this may be said of all Oriental people. The sense and fear of danger is highly developed in them, and there is no cultivation of the indifference to it which has distinguished the great nations of Western Europe. Page 205. Were a non-Jew to call attention to this difference between the Jews and others, he would be met with a cry of anti-Semitism, and he would be twitted with the fact that all his relatives may not have served in the war. Loudest to twit him would be those who served in what our soldiers called the Jewish infantry, the quartermaster's corps in the late National Army, that's the supply division. It is to this aversion to danger, however, that Mr. Levy attributes the Jews' greatness among the nations. Other nations can fight, the Jews can endure, and that, he says, is greater. Note his words, the italics are his own. Other nations may boast conquests and triumphs born of aggression, but though the fruits of victory have been manifold, they have not been enduring. Italics, and it may be truly said that the nation whose greatness grows out of valor, an italics, passes through the stages of discord and degeneracy to decay. In the virtue of endurance, I believe the Jews have a safeguard against the decay that has marked the history of all other peoples. It appears, therefore, that the draft dodger, if he can endure long enough, may yet come to own the country. Jewish leaders have tried lately to minimize as, quote, wild words, unquote, the disclosures made by Disraeli with reference to the Jews' participation in European revolutions. What Disraeli said can be found in his Coningsby, or in the quotations made therefrom in the Dearborn Independent of December 18, 1920. With reference, and these are the socialist revolutions in the mid-centuries of the 1900s that drove a lot of people to America from Germany and elsewhere in Europe. With reference to the German Revolution of 1848, Disraeli wrote, before it had taken place, "You never observe a great intellectual movement in Europe in which the Jews do not greatly participate. That mysterious Russian diplomacy, which so alarms Western Europe, is organized and principally carried on by Jews. That mighty revolution, which is at this moment preparing in Germany, and which will be, in fact, a second and greater reformation, and of which so little is yet known in England, is entirely developing under the auspices of Jews. This was what eventually culminated in the Russian revolution, the communists. He's talking about this decades earlier. It is the abortive 1848 revolutions that failed. It is interesting, therefore, to hear Mr. Levy confirming from the American side those significant statements made by Disraeli. Levy says, "The revolution of 1848 in Germany, however, influenced a great many highly educated Jews to come to America," page 181. "It is unnecessary to review the events of 1848. Suffice it to say that not a few among the revolutionists were Jews, and that a considerable number of those who were proscribed by the government at home fled to the U.S. for safety." Page 182. Yeah, we got a lot of socialists come over from that. "These German Jews are now the arch financiers of the United States. They found here complete liberty to exploit peoples and nations to the full extent of their powers. They still maintain their connections with Frankfurt on the Main, the world capital of international financial Jewry." With these quotations from the speeches and writings of Leo N. Levy, a famous president of the B'nai B'rith, it would seem to be a fair question as to the reason for the denial and denunciation which have followed the making of these statements in the course of the series of studies. Leo N. Levy studied the Jewish question because he knew a Jewish question to exist. He knew that the Jewish question was not a non-Jewish creation, but appeared wherever Jews began to appear in numbers. They brought it with them. He knew the justice of many of the charges laid against the Jews. He knew the impossibility of disproving them, the futility of shrieking anti-Semitism at them. He knew, moreover, that for the Jews to solve the Jewish question by departing from the peculiar racial traditions of racial superiority would be to cease to be Jews. Therefore, he threw his whole influence on the side of the Jews remaining separate, maintaining their tradition of the chosen race, looking upon themselves as the coming rulers of the nations. And there he left the question just about where he found it. So basically he concedes the case and just says Jews just need to be separate and exclusive and we'll just see what happens. Fully in line with the protocols, world program. But in the course of his studies, he gave other investigators the benefit of his frank statements. He did not put lies into the mouths of his people. He was not endeavoring to maintain himself in position by prejudiced racial appeals. He looked certain facts in the face, made his report, and chose his side. Several times in the course of his argument, his very logic led him up to the point where, logically, he would have to cast aside his Jewish idea of separateness. But with great calmness, he discarded the logic and clung to the Jewish tradition. For example, "The better to facilitate such happiness in every country and every age, various kinds of organizations have existed as they exist today. The Jews have theirs. Quote, for many reasons they are exclusive. In theory, they should not be so. In our social organizations, we should, in deference to the argument which I have already named, admit any congenial and worthy Gentile who honors us with his application. But what may be theoretically correct may be found practically wrong. It certainly is a wrong to exclude a worthy person because he does not happen to be a Jew, but on the other hand, where are you to draw the line? This is frankness to a fault. Of course it is wrong, but the right is impractical. Logic goes by the boards in the face of something stronger. Mr. Levy is not to be blamed for having gone to his tribe. Every man's place is with his tribe. The criticism belongs to the lickspittle Gentile fronts who have no tribe and become hangers-on around the outskirts of Judah, racial mongrels who would be better off if they had 1/1000th of the racial sense which the Jew possesses. This brief survey of the philosophy which Mr. Levy both lived and taught and which is shared by the leaders of American Jewry is in strict agreement with Jewish principles all down the centuries. In his published addresses, Mr. Levy does not touch upon all the implications of the separateness which he enjoins upon his nation, commands them to it. Why do they keep to themselves? What is it that keeps them distinct? Is it their religion? Very well, let us regard them as a sect of religious recluses and wish them well in their endeavors to keep themselves unspotted of the world. Is it their race? So their leaders teach. Race and nationality are strictly claimed. If this is so, there must be a political outlook. What is it? Palestine? Not that anyone can notice. A great deal may be read about it in the newspapers, the newspapers in turn being supplied through the Associated Press with the Jewish Telegraph Agency's propaganda dispatches, but no one in Palestine notices the land becoming more Jewish. Jewry's political outlook is world rule in the material sense. Jewry is an international nation. It is this and nothing else which gives significance to its financial, educational, propagandist, revolutionary, and immigration programs. So, if they were content to be merely religious recluses, no one would need to say anything other than wish you well. But theirs is the world program, as it's called in the protocols, looking for a world autocrat. And they mean to rule the world. Their political outlook, their political agenda, their political program is for their world rule in the material sense. So we must take note of what they're up to. And then so much for that chapter talking about Leo Levy, head of the B'nai B'rith. This article appeared in May of 1921, the 14th of May, 1921, in the Dearborn Independent. And so that will conclude chapter 55 of the 80 of the International Jew. And as I say, you can find all these recordings that we do and these discussions at vnnforum.com. Thanks for listening today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.